The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, they added $500 extra billion to our GDP just by changing the accounting in August. First thing that you and I said was, we need to get John Williams on and have him explain just why this is more real than it is.
And lo and behold, all of a sudden, the depression in the 1930s was not as bad as we thought it was. Neither was any recession moving forward. We've had more growth in the economy, and we just didn't appreciate how good we had it. Well, this is one of the reasons why we continue to read and have a conversation with John Williams, because he is looking beyond and behind the government statistics and helping to clarify what has been utterly politicized and what can still be relied on as a healthy reference point in the decision-making process that each individual listener and, of course, we ourselves are making as it relates to our finances. You know, to look at economics today, unfortunately, it's not the dismal science. That would be complimentary. It's becoming the stupid science, where we have so much confidence in numbers that actually have so little relevance and truth to them. Yes, we need a John Williams to just pencil it out and say, here's what's changed and why. And if you want to look back over the decades, these are the points at which it's changed, whether it was in 1999 or 1984 or 1970. These are the things that have changed. It's helpful. With that in mind, let's go right into our conversation. John, I've heard you say that nothing today is normal. I mean, in a nutshell, maybe you could explore what you see as the real economic backdrop and comment on the mind games that are being played with the general public. You know, you've got the governing elites, you've got the Fed, and they are playing these perception-oriented games. Maybe you can paint a more accurate picture.
Sure. Right now, I'll contend that we're still living with the aftershocks of the panic that took place in 2008. The problems go well back before that. The economy started to turn down in reality about 2006, 2007. You saw that in the housing sector, which helped to trigger the credit crisis. And as the economy turned down and the credit crisis broke, you had a financial panic, which intensified the economic downturn. It has taken us into the deepest and most protracted economic downturn seen since the Great Depression. Now, the official version of what's happened is that the economy tanked into the middle of 2009, and as of June 2009, the economy started to turn up and has continued upward ever since, fully recovering, meaning that it had reached its pre-recession level back in the second quarter of 2011. That's 9 quarters ago, more than 2 years ago. And now it's 4 or 5% above where it was before the recession started. The problem with that is that there is no other major economic series that shows that pattern. In theory, the GDP is supposed to reflect other economic reporting. The series is a theoretical construct that came out of academia back in the 20s. As with many things like this that are trying to model the economy, it had to be simplified in order to make it work. And in the simplification, you find that the numbers move away from economic reality, the real-world experience. And there's a basic reporting flaws within the GDP itself. But more recently, in the last couple of decades, the government has exacerbated the problem by changing the way inflation is reported. And inflation is an important factor in the GDP reporting. The GDP number is reported net of inflation. You're trying to see what the economy is doing. Not whether or not, say, retail sales are rising because prices are rising. You want to see what the retail sales are doing net of inflation. If you understate the inflation that you use, and as the government does, if you understate the inflation that you're using in adjusting the GDP, you end up overstating that inflation-adjusted growth. And that's why we've seen the economic recovery in the official GDP reporting. It's also a part of the reason we haven't seen it in things such as payroll employment, which is still well below where it was going into the recession. That has no inflation factors in it whatsoever. If you correct for the inflation distortion, what you'll see is that the actual GDP started turning down in 2006. The official is it started turning down right after December of 2007. That was the peak. Plunges into the middle of 2009. That's consistent. But instead of recovering, it has been bottom bouncing basically ever since, very stagnant, and in the last couple of quarters, it started to turn down again. I'll contend that's a lot closer to common experience. so that the official recovery is basically a statistical illusion. And this has all sorts of implications, ranging from the Fed's programs to what the government's doing and can do. If you look at the deficit projections, they're based on economic assumptions going forward. All the economic projections going forward on the budget are based on positive economic growth. We're not going to have that for some time. And there's a good reason for it that I'll get back to in a minute. The estimates of the federal budget deficit are based on positive economic growth going forward. Nothing is quite as it appears. And the biggest issue, as I see it, remains that the system itself is not stable. The banking system is not stable. All the Fed easing actions have been aimed at providing liquidity to the banking system. The Fed's primary goal, Fed's primary function, is to keep the banking system afloat. Granted, there's a mandate by Congress that the Fed needs to contain inflation and maintain sustainable economic growth the best it can, but there's very little the Fed can do right now to stimulate the economy. The Fed can always contract the economy, and it can always increase inflation, but it's difficult to bring inflation down once it's up, and it's difficult to get the economy up when it's down. So that when you have the Fed talking about all the possible qualifications as to what economic conditions would lead it to cut back on its easing, that's largely nonsense. The Fed's primary concern in the easing is the maintaining the stability in the banking system, and it's using the weakness in the economy, which continues, as political cover for doing so. The reason that you have ongoing economic weakness and the reason we have no recovery in place and none that is about to hit us is largely tied to the consumer. There are numbers that are put out by a private company that was started by several or a couple of senior Census Bureau officials where they report on a monthly basis median household income, the median level of household income adjusted for inflation using the government's consumer price index. And it's a very interesting, if you look at it, where the government publishes an annual number, they have this broken out monthly. And what the monthly data show you is that when the economy, as economy plunged off the cliff, and you came to the so-called recovery in June of 2009, median household income continued to plummet. And then it hit a low level of stagnation, and it's still there. It hasn't recovered. There's no way that you can have a sustainable economic recovery. You cannot have a sustainable consumption without sustainable growth in income. That's a basic. Income will drive consumption. Now, you can borrow some growth from the future through debt expansion. And going back a couple of decades, when Alan Greenspan was Fed chairman, he recognized that there was a fundamental problem here in terms of consumer income. What you're seeing today in you look at the government's last estimate of median household income, which is for the year 2011, and that's, again, adjusted using the CPIU. It was below where it was back in 1967. The average guy's not making it. And the reason that you've had this terrible decline in income is because jobs basically have been lost offshore or to offshore competition. The higher-paying jobs, the production jobs, and with that kind of constraint on household income, where back in the 70s when this really began to develop, where you had more commonly a household where the mother would stay home with the children and the father would go out and work, today it's much more common that you have at least the two income earners in a household. And even so, the households are not staying even. Now, Greenspan, seeing that there was a problem here that was going to impact the economy, began very actively encouraging debt growth. And indeed, we saw a period of debt expansion that was unprecedented in modern times here. And debt leverage was built upon debt leverage. And then we had the crisis in 2008 where effectively you had the debt collapse. So what's happened now, what we see with the consumer is that, number one, he or she still has the same limitations in terms of income as before the crisis. In fact, that has intensified. But they no longer have the ability to expand their debt the way they did before to make a shortfall in their living standards. And until something is done to address the basic consumer liquidity problem, there's no hope of a sustainable economic recovery. That's not in the works.
As you know, many deflationists argue that given the total stock of liabilities outstanding, which you just suggested, Greenspan helped promote a massive amount of debt growth through his 20-year tenure, they contend, the deflationists do, that there is a deflationary contraction ahead a shrinkage of credit, and that dollars will be in high demand, forcing a major move higher in the dollar. By contrast, I believe you see heavy dollar selling more likely with, dollar-based commodity prices rising, in turn leading to price inflation domestically. How would you, John, address the deflationary concerns given the total stock of debt out there and the monetary machinery that we have in place?
Well, in order to have a deflation of the type that some people fear, such as you had in the 1930s, you need to have a collapse in the money supply. What happened in the 30s was that you had a bank failures where people actually lost the deposits at their banks. They have their savings at the local bank. The local bank went under. There was no FDIC insurance. The cash was just gone. And as the banking system began to implode, so too did the money supply, because those deposits were not there. There was no way of them recovering them. Now, back in the 2008, Bernanke and crowd were very fearful of a massive deflation, like you saw in the 1930s, if the banking system collapsed. They were afraid we were on the brink of a collapse here, and we were. I mean, they weren't kidding. At that point in time, spent, created whatever money they had to do, guaranteed, they loaned whatever money they had to loan in order to keep the system afloat. Whatever they had to do, they did. They weren't too concerned about the long-term impact. They're just trying to short-term survival of the system. What they succeeded in doing was buying a little time and pushing the problems down the road. But there isn't a thing they did that fundamentally resolved the problems in the system. And those systems are still there. I don't think you're going to have a collapse in the money supply, because I would fully expect that they're going to do whatever they have to do to ensure the domestic depositors. The collapse of debt does not by itself contract the money supply. I mean, that's, some people say, oh, the debt's crashed, you know, the money supply is going to go with that. If I'm a bank, and let's say I lend you $1 million. In normal times, that $1 million would then maybe expand to $10 million in the money supply, because you'd go out, you'd spend the money anywhere you deposited in your bank, you'd spend the money. And as the cash got deposited at different banks, all those banks would in turn lend more money, creating maybe a tenfold increase of the money that you had. Now you go under. Say, I can't pay back that $1 million. I'm the bank. I want the $1 million back. I can't go into the system and pull that $1 million out of the system. It's already spread throughout the system. So if I could pull that money out of the system, that would create a reverse expansion of the money supply. Where I can't do that, I have to take a hit on my balance sheet. And as my balance sheet gets hurt, that limits my ability to lend money. That's what happened here. So I saw a slow attrition of the pace of growth in the money supply. We actually went negative briefly. We saw some negative inflation, nothing worse than we saw back in the 1950s. This is, again, based on official government reporting. If it weren't for the gimmicks they put into place to understate inflation, the low rate of deflation that we actually had in this post-crisis period, and now we're back up in an inflationary area, would never have been deflation. We would have been 3 to 5% higher than we are now in terms of annual inflation. The reason that we're going to have a hyperinflation is tied to the basic insolvency of the U.S. government. This was in place before the crisis of 2008. Some people say, oh, Williams, you've been talking about a hyperinflation for years. Yes, I have, but I've been talking about it in the future. I've been talking about first initially towards the end of the current decade, and then after the crisis of 2008, pulling in the forecast horizon to next year. The issue here is that the federal government is beyond control in terms of its fiscal policy. It's evident when you look at the games the politicians played back in July of 2011 and all the gimmicks trying to balancing the budget off until after the election and the resulting sequester. And now we've got a debt ceiling and another fiscal crisis that are going to come to a head in September, which is when I think you're going to see very heavy selling pressure against the dollar. And heavy selling pressure against the dollar here is also tied to the monetary policies of the Fed. What the Fed has done is it's tried to debase the dollar. Nobody wants, in the right mind that I see, wants to hold the dollar. They're doing it for political reasons. They want to get out of it as soon as they can, minimize their losses. But as people start to dump the dollar, you will see the dollar's exchange rate value decline. That becomes very inflationary. Now, this is not inflationary from the standpoint of, oh, boy, we've got a strong economy. You'll hear a lot of people saying, oh, yes, we need to see some inflation here because that means strong economic growth. There are two types of inflation. There's one, which is, and people like to think of this as the more common type, although it isn't, at least it hasn't been in the last couple of decades. that you have a strong economy. Demand is up there, not enough goods. So as the excess money chases the goods, the prices rise, production increases, people get hired. That's a relatively healthy inflation. That's where the economic demand is pushing the prices higher. The type that we're seeing is one where the commodity prices are being driven higher by a weak dollar. Direct relationship between the weakness in the dollar and the spiking of oil prices. What happens if higher oil prices? We get higher gasoline prices. The great volatility that we've seen in the year-to-year change in inflation recently has been tied largely to swings in gasoline prices, and you can largely tie those to the Fed's institution of quantitative easing or actions taken directly at weakening the dollar. I think we've got a major dollar crisis ahead here. Again, September is when the debt ceiling crisis will have to be resolved. Right now, the Treasury is playing games avoiding the breaking the debt ceiling, but there will come a time right after Labor Day where they will have no choice, and the Congress will have to act, and how it goes, I can't tell you, but I do think there's going to be some terrible contentiousness, re-raising all the issues that the world is looking at, and I'm talking to global markets, in terms of the long-term solvency questions, sovereign solvency issues of the United States. You say, well, we budget deficits coming down this year. Nonsense. That's a cash-based deficit. They have some gimmicks where they've had declared dividends out of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which the government effectively has guaranteed and should be putting on its balance sheet and should be putting their debt on its balance sheet instead of just claiming dividends and such. If you look at the government's financial condition, the way a corporation does, using generally accepted accounting principles or GAAP, what you'll see is that the deficit in the last fiscal year ended September 30th, 2012, was $6.6 trillion, not $1.1 trillion, which is a cash base. $6.6 trillion is beyond containment. We've been averaging $5 trillion a year actual deficit for the last 5 years. It gets worse by that amount each year. Now, if you have, let's say in 1 year you just wanted to eliminate that deficit, you run into serious problems. From a tax standpoint, you could raise taxes and take 100% of people's wages and salaries. You'd still be in deficit. You could cut every penny of government spending, including defense spending, but not touch Medicare, Social Security. You'd still be in deficit. In order for the United States to become solvent, where it has the ability to meet its future obligations without just printing money, which is where it's headed right now, and that's what gives you the hyperinflation, you have to have severe cutting of the budget, all sorts of areas, but the social programs, there's like some form of it, Social Security, Medicare in particular, have to be altered so that they're functionally solvent, that they cover themselves. That's very difficult to do over time. And it's you have no political will whatsoever in Washington that I've seen by the people currently controlling the government to do that. I don't see that happening. And that is what's threatening the long-term solvency of the United States. That's what's going to cause a terrible sell-off in the U.S. dollar in the months ahead. I can't give you precise timing on that. It's not the type of thing that is subject to precise that. But the fundamentals are there, and as the dollar weakens, you're going to see significant inflation. As foreign holders of the dollar increasingly dump dollars, they'll dump dollar-denominated paper assets, such as U.S. Treasury. The Fed's going to have to intervene to prop up those markets, and all of a sudden you're going to see the money supply starting to explode.
So, John, if I understand you correctly, it's not really the issue of quantitative easing, either a continuation of that or an expansion, which will bring about higher rates of inflation. The direct monetization of assets we've seen of late, but you're saying it's much more basic than that. That may be icing on the cake. It's the fiscal policies that are beyond control.
Well, the fiscal policy were sound, and the world had confidence in it. The Fed wouldn't have to be buying treasuries. I mean, the Fed, again, I think their primary reason here is trying to provide solvency to the banking system, but I think to a certain extent, they're also trying to make those treasury auctions go well. Right now, based on the expansion of QE through that went into effect in January of this year, when they started the buying again of the U.S. Treasury securities, and that's a significant one in terms of the monetization. Since the beginning of the year, the Fed has now bought more than the total net issuance of the U.S. government of its treasury debt since the beginning of the year. Now, that means the Fed has basically absorbed all the treasury issuance, and yet interest rates are going higher. Well, part of the reason is that you're seeing some dumping of foreign-held treasury securities, and that's something of a balance to the Fed's efforts to keep interest rates low. But if you buy up all the supply, at least for a while, you have some pretty good control over the pricing, and of course the pricing here is interest rates. They're going to continue trying what they're doing now. I don't see that they have an alternative. I don't say they could possibly end the easing if they're looking to keep the system afloat. They're just trying to buy time, hoping things will, they'll somehow find a way of working the system out, getting the economy growing, bringing the deficit under control. I just don't see it working, which gets you to a point which is, I know, very discouraging for people, and it's, believe me, it's discouraging for me too, but you get to a point where if you don't see them having a happy solution, you still have good news, and that is that being aware of what's happening, you can take action to protect yourself.
John, earlier we were talking about GDP, and we've changed some of the variables that go into GDP, adding credence to what I thought I heard you describing earlier as a highly politicized number. How have we changed it? Did the Commerce Department further skew the lens we look through, or have they brought us closer to economic reality and real-world activity?
Well, the GDP over time just keeps moving away from real-world activity. Again, the concepts are very heavily simplified to make the numbers work. Every 10 years or so, they go through what they call a comprehensive revision, and they redefine the series. The problem is each time they redefine the series, they restate prior economic history and up the level of activity. We just had such a revision. If you look at the reporting for, let's say, 1929, which is the beginning of the historical series and what they publish now, versus where it was reported in 1950, in the latest reporting, that's now 1.2% higher than it was estimated at in 1950. You go to 1933, the depths of the Depression, that number today is 3% higher than it was in 1950. So we've seen some mitigation of the depth of the Great Depression. And this is just because they've redefined the series. They come up with ways of making the economy look stronger, but they always carry it back in time to try and have it on a consistent basis. But they also make changes that will help the current period and accelerate the growth, because what you see is when, let's say, you look at the reporting of 1960 on the economy, as it was reported as recently as 1984, that's now roughly 8% higher than it was. 1970s now 9% higher than it was. 1980s 10% higher than it was. And you get here, I mean, it just gets worse and worse as you go along.
John, it feels like this is just outright unmitigated balderdash. You're revising history, and it feels like the kind of thing that you would expect to see out of communist Russia. You burn the old textbooks, you send the professors, the dissidents, to the gulag, and you completely rewrite history. How is it that students of tomorrow will appreciate that the numbers that they're looking at are entirely bogus and cannot be trusted?
What they do is with academic backing, there's some theoretical structure to it. But let me give you an example of the absurdity. The national income accounts, of which the GDP, the gross domestic product, is part of, it's effectively an accounting system. You have the GDP, which measures consumption. Then you have the GDI, which is the gross domestic income as opposed to the gross domestic product, but along with saving, will theoretically be exactly equal to the GDP. They can't get them close. They're lucky to get them within 10% of each other. And part of the reason, again, has to do with it, well, the simplifying assumption. For example, I bet the average person who owns a home didn't realize that they're earning rental income on the homes that they own from themselves. Of course not. But that's the way the government works it. They have what they call homeowner's equivalent rent. If you own your house, they will impute that, as an owner of the house, that you rent your house from yourself. They'll estimate how much that is. And they'll also estimate how much you're raising the rent on yourself each year. So that only adds to your income. And you'll see that in the personal income numbers. It also is the same concept is included in the Consumer Price Index. So depending upon how much you rent your house to yourself or how much the rent you're raising on yourself is, that affects that's the single largest component of the CPI. It's about 23% of the CPI. It's absolute nonsense. Or the markets will concentrate on the GDP numbers. I'll call it the most worthless number around. They put statistical significance around the quarter-to-quarter changes, and they annualize it, because most of the time, historically, you've had positive economic growth. So if you annualize it, you magnify the growth. Average annualized quarterly growth over time runs around 3%. That's net of inflation. The error margin around the quarter-to-quarter estimates is a little over 3%. So on average, you don't know the economy's expanding or contracting, but nobody pays any attention to that.
John, are economists all around the world convinced of the academic integrity of these kinds of moves? Or is it fair to say that our foreign creditors should be concerned when they see us massaging our official statistics like they did in communist Russia during the Cold War?
Well, there certainly have been disagreements over it. For example, with the inflation changes, where our government has introduced what they call hedonic quality adjustments. From an inflation standpoint, quality adjustments for inflation are very standard. I mean, if people go out, survey prices of all sorts of goods. They look at a variety of factors that you can directly measure. For example, you have a candy bar that's in an 8-ounce wrapper. Next month, it's the same size package, but it's a 6-ounce candy bar. They're supposed to notice that and physically adjust the calculations for it. But if you have a textbook that now has a colored picture in it, or you have a dryer that's got a digital readout instead of a mechanical dial that, you know, tells you how much time you have, that's a quality improvement that there's no direct way of measuring, but the government has developed models that will estimate it for you. It has nothing to do with what the average guy is looking for or thinks he's spending on things, but it has the effect of that when they use these systems, they reduce the inflation rate, and that boosts the inflation-adjusted growth. Well, when we first introduced hedonic quality adjustments into the GDP, countries such as Japan and Germany didn't follow along. And as a result, our economy started booming along while Japan and Germany were lagging behind, Japan in particular. And you look at the lost decade that Japan had, that never happened. The difference was largely in who was using hedonic quality adjustments in their GDP calculations. It's something that people who are familiar with what is reported, what's involved in the international standards, are familiar with. Usually the U.S. standards get adopted as the international standards, and that's pretty much the case now. But there are other areas where it still doesn't happen. For example, Canada will count discouraged workers, people who aren't actively looking for work, but they're otherwise unemployed. They take a job in a minute if it were available. They're able, willing to work. They want the job. They've just looked too long. They can't find one. The United States, you're not counted as a discouraged worker if you've been looking for more than a year. In Canada, there's no time limit.
In other words, you fall out of the statistic altogether in the U.S., but you stay in the statistic in Canada. Well, we've talked about inflation, deflation, we've talked about the GDP changes, we've talked about a number of the statistics which are massaged in addition to GDP, U3 and U6. One thing we haven't talked about, which you do give comment to here and there, you've commented that the rise of gold was fundamental, but that the intermittent selling of gold has not been. Is your pro-gold position, is it directly tied to your position on the dollar and where you see the dollar going, which would be lower, over the next several years?
Well, gold is the ultimate hedge here. So is silver is. But I look at basically physical gold is the ultimate hedge against extreme dollar debasement that lies ahead of us. I think that's fairly well recognized. The thing is, you're going to see a lot of manipulations by governments and central banks. We've seen that. We're likely going to see further. But as long as we're headed for the ultimate debasement of the currency, it doesn't make too much difference if you get your gold at $250 an ounce or $5,000 an ounce, or you get it at $5,000, it goes down to $3,000. When it gets up to $100,000 an ounce, it will be doing its job of preserving the purchasing power of the dollars that you put into it. And that's where I see the ultimate value in gold. It's an insurance policy, but it isn't any good if you don't hold the insurance policy. So the way I look at it is that people who have assets and want to preserve them through what's going to be an extraordinarily difficult time ahead, where the paper dollars, the dollar-denominated paper assets, the physical currency, will become virtually worthless. To the extent you get that into gold or some hard asset that will retain its value, you can preserve the purchasing power of your assets and your wealth. And you ride out the storm, and when the storm's over, hopefully you'll have a circumstance that's relatively positive going forward and have some of the best investment opportunities that anyone has ever seen. But you need the assets and liquid assets in order to do that. So I look at holding gold as a longer-term proposition to get you through the crisis, not to play the day-to-day market. And, I mean, there are people who do that, and God bless them. And, you know, so you get into the day-to-day gambling, that's fine, you just as long as you know what you're doing. I would always have my basic hedge in place. And then, you know, whatever money you want to play with beyond that, you play with in the stocks or futures markets, whatever. But you need to know what you're doing. You don't want to have open-ended exposures and such. The basics, so you need to ensure your fundamental asset base.
Well, John, we've always benefited from our conversations with you and continue to benefit from the tireless work that you do putting together the analysis at Shadow Government Statistics. As you say, analysis behind and beyond government economic reporting. How important is it to have a clue what reality actually is when the goalposts are constantly being moved, when words are being changed, semantics are manipulatable, when reality, as we thought we were dealing with, is shifting all around us? So thank you for helping clarify and elucidate these issues, whether it's the GDP revisions, whether it is the July jobs gains, whether it is CPI, PPI, new and existing home sales. You look at so many different things, and you do a great job of it. I would encourage our listeners to visit your website, shadowstats.com, and if you don't read John Williams, you don't know what you're missing. And unfortunately, you probably do believe, along with the general public, that what you're being told in terms of government statistics have the veracity which you believe them to have. And that's unfortunate, because the decisions that you're making are ill-informed decisions. That doesn't have to be the case. Spend some time at shadowstats.com. Spend some time getting to know John Williams' work. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as always, David, it's enlightening to have John on. You know, I had to laugh when he was talking about the homeowner equivalent rent. Okay, how much am I renting my own house from myself for, and how much income is it bringing me? I would be rich if I accounted the way the government does.
Well, like I started by saying, this is beyond the dismal science. This is the stupid science.
It's snake oil.
What I don't appreciate is the complete revision of history. I mean, as a student of history, and many in this office spend endless hours reading through, whether it is the Civil War or World War I or World War II, what if someone came along and completely rewrote that history? And yet that's what we're seeing happen, right, on an economic basis. And the advantage that we've had of higher growth rates and of a more stable dollar over the last 20 to 30 years, it appears to be fiction. It appears to be a manipulation of reality. We stood head and shoulders above the rest. On what basis? On the basis of figuring out how to effectively lie and communicate those lies to a good, large audience globally and not get caught at it. That is tragic. That is absolutely tragic. Well, another conversation with John Williams, and look forward to the next one as hopefully we begin to see numbers get better, not worse, at least in terms of what we understand them to be, their truth and not their fiction.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, John Williams. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.